Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 3rd of August. Actually, I need to skip back a week because last week's episode ended on a cliffhanger. On the Sunday, that's last Sunday now, Martin was going to read in church the story of Abraham, God, and Sodom. How would it go? Would he get the comedy of it across without being disrespectful? Would he have them rolling in the aisles? Just to remind you, this story from Genesis is when God plans to destroy Sodom for its wickedness, and Abraham tells him he can't possibly, if there are even 50 just men in it, not if he wants to behave the way a truly just God has to behave. God, having been told how a proper God should act, says, "All right, 50 just men it is." Whereupon Abraham deploys his negotiating skills. First he asks for a 10% discount, which gets the number down to 45. Then he tries for 40 men, 30 men, 20 men, all the way down to 10 just men. At which point Abraham considers it wisest to stop. The reason for valuing this passage is not that it is entertaining, though it is, but the way it shows the kind of relationship that we, the children and stepchildren of Abraham, are allowed to have with the force that created the universe. Last Sunday, in church, I tried to put as much life and sparkle into the reading as I could, without actually turning it into a performance and distracting everyone. How well I succeeded, I can't tell, because people behave at Mass the way they would at a piano recital. They sit still and don't betray emotion. What heartened me enormously, though, was the sermon. Last Sunday's Gospel was full of easy sermon topics, the Lord's Prayer, and the general injunction to ask and it will be given you. But no, the priest went straight for the first reading and Abraham's auction. His sermon was wise and deep, but what I was most grateful for was the fact that he chose that topic at all. This reading from Genesis isn't there just because the liturgists felt they had to put it in. It has a point to it, and a definite and a distinctive point. The point is this. The pagans treat themselves as specks of dust in comparison with the infinite, as beings with no power in the face of power itself. So they grovel. They beg. They bribe, sacrificing goats, oxen, sheep, enemies, slaves, children. They make up more and more elaborate prayers until the prayer formulas themselves seem to them to have power, so that in the end what started as religion becomes just magic. We, sons and daughters of Abraham, have been given more by God. We have been given a relationship. It is not an equal relationship, of course not. I loathe the people who talk about what a friend I have in Jesus, as if they were about to slap him on the back. But a relationship it is, all the same. Of course there is the respect one should always have whenever there is inequality, but there is communication. Moses talks to God face to face as a man talks with his friend. Moses also complains vigorously to God when the people of Israel get out of hand in the wilderness, and God obligingly sorts it out. So it goes on throughout the Old Testament, and then when the New Testament comes along, suddenly, for a few brief years, we even have a new way of talking to God face to face. Abraham's auction tells us he may be the power who created the universe, he may have created you, but he created you in his own image, so talk to him. So let's do that. There is another thing that was left half finished last week because there wasn't time. And that is the business of saints and why we suddenly seem to be getting so many of them. Pope John Paul II started it, and his successors have carried on. I have to say that I've been kicked into action on this by an email from a listener. He said he was nostalgic for the old days when there were fewer saints, just the really special ones. He liked it like that. Saints should be the best of the best, he said. Hall of Fame, I think he said. It's a delight when someone writes in, because it means he's been listening, and it's even better when he shows me that what I didn't have time to say last week shouldn't be left out, because it's actually worth saying. So here goes. Where the best of the best is concerned, of course none of us has any idea how to measure the greatness and glory of saints, still less to compare them. Still, for the moment, Accepting that we can't really know, let's agree that in practice someone like, say, John the Baptist is more likely to be looked up to as a saint than, say, Pope Saint Sixtus II, who was pope for 1 year in 257 before he had his head cut off by the Emperor Valerian. Sixtus's feast is this Thursday. Those words, likely to be looked up to, have a literal meaning. Physically, the great saints really are often found in churches on plinths, pillars, in niches in the walls. That is a position we can associate in our minds with a hall of fame. Physically, when you look up at the saints up there, you get a crick in the neck. Spiritually, looking up at the saints up there can do you a different kind of harm. Here is the danger of the high up and holy, best of the best attitude to the saints. It makes us too comfortable and complacent. It divides the human race into two kinds of individuals. One, a minority, is the saints. They had an extra load of grace dumped on them by God at birth. It wasn't their fault, but burdened with that grace, they automatically lived their lives as saints. They walked around among us being holier than us, gooder than us, achieving greater things than us. Quite a lot of them ended up as martyrs, which made them holier still. That is the first class of human beings. It is the top class, the holy class, the best of the best, the hall of fame. Rather below these great ones, there is the populace, the rest of us. Mediocrities, fortunately unburdened by a load of extra grace that might force us to do things that could make us uncomfortable. We potter around this world, neither particularly good nor particularly bad. We dirty ourselves with sin from time to time and get our faces scrubbed for us by Mother Church. Dying, we rather hope we'll get the benefit of the doubt and slip into purgatory among a cohort of other people just like us, guilty of nothing more serious than being a bit of a waste of space. The bad thing about any class system is not that some people end up at the bottom. The bad thing is that being at the bottom is a wonderful excuse not to do anything about it, not to attempt to do anything or achieve anything. This works just the same with sanctity as it does with anything else. We say to ourselves, we are little people, and the great thing about being little is that little is demanded of you. So that is the risk of seeing saints as Hall of Fame supermen. It tempts you and me to see ourselves as nothing in comparison, to make us feel content to do nothing because we feel called to do nothing. But remember the parable of the man whose master gave him just one talent. He had much less than his fellow servants, and he sat on what little he had to keep it safe. He didn't even try to use it. He was cast into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Of course, I don't know exactly why the Holy Spirit inspired John Paul II to canonize more saints and his successors to follow his lead. But it might be that this was a way to remove that saints as supermen excuse. The saints are not far, far above us. They are among us, and by logic it follows that we are among them. We are not down here looking up at them. We are shoulder to shoulder with them, and they with us. Whatever they were called to do, we are called to do. Each in our own way we are meant to be Saint Me or Saint You. More saints means less excuse for laziness, less excuse for not trying. I like the way St. Paul pulls sporting analogies into his letters, I have run the race, and so on, so let me try a sporting way of looking at this business of saints. It would be possible to consider sport as a matter of champions. Television encourages us to do it. Champions whose championness has been poured out on them from above. Their job is to stand up there on the podium being admired, just as our job is to lie on sofas eating crisps and doing the admiring. We do our job rather well. This is comfortable. It is also a lie and ultimately toxic. The sports that flourish, the sports that do actual good to mankind, are the ones in which everyone participates, whatever their fitness, whatever their talent. In such a sport, when I applaud someone who is up there standing on the podium, it is not because he is the kind of magic person that was designed from birth to stand up there. No, he is no different from me. Or perhaps, as the schoolboy said about frogs and toads, he is just like me, only different. Just possibly his body equipped him a little better. Perhaps he worked harder. Perhaps he had more time to do the work. But nevertheless, potentially he is me and I am him. That is what sport is about, and one of the good effects of sport is that contemplating him and knowing this, I may do something about myself. I may push myself more. Something may come of it. I hope you can transpose all this from sports back to saints and see the sort of thing that I am not very efficiently trying to get at. With all these modern canonizations, we see firmly that the saints are among us, not just above us. Can't be a saint because I am confined to bed and can't move? Consider St. Ledwina. Can't be a saint because I am a homeless vagrant? Consider St. Benedict Joseph Labre. Can't be a saint because I am no better than a slave? Consider St. Callistus, or St. Josephine Bakhita, or Benedict the Black, who were slaves. Can't be a saint because of where I live? Not an excuse. There are saints now from every continent and practically every country. They aren't token saints either, and it is humbling to read their stories. Madagascar in particular still stands out in my mind. Can't be a saint because I'm too young. Saints Francisco and Jacinta Mato were 8 and 6 years old at Fatima, and they died in the Spanish flu epidemic when they were 10. Blessed Carlo Acutis was 15 when he died. He is going to be canonized in a month's time. Thus it is that we see that the saints are among us. It is good, it is great, it is true. It is also terrible. I have to forget the comfortable notion of saints being different beings far above us, safely far above, so that I can't be expected to imitate them. They are among us and we are among them, and there are no excuses for us not to be like them. How do you spot a saint? I wonder about this, and then I remember the ants. When I was a child, my parents discovered a wonderfully economical way to make a garden pond in the middle of the lawn. You invite all your son's school friends to tea. You show them a patch that you've marked out with string, and you say, "Look, here is a place you are allowed to dig." Leave a few trowels lying around, and the job is done. A nice hole for a pond, with, behind it, a small hill made from the spoil. That grassy hill was a lovely place to lie on in the summer, with a book, of course. The trouble with the grassy hill was that, being a hill, it was drier than its surroundings and warmer too, just the kind of place that ants love. Not the ordinary busy black ants either, but the tiny angry little red ones that swarm and bite. You'd lie down and start to read, and suddenly they'd be all over your legs and up your shorts. Most undignified. So, carefully, before sitting on the hill, you stop and you look, and you see nothing. You look and you look, still nothing. You look and you look and you look, nothing. You stop looking, and almost at once you see an ant scurrying along. And here's the thing, once you have seen one, you see lots of them everywhere. It is as if your eyes have said, "Oh, that was what you wanted to see, why didn't you say?" And they tune themselves into the ant frequency, and you see them all. So you give up the idea of the hill and go and sit on the bench instead. My friend tells me it's the same in the jungle when you're up a tree looking out for the jaguar. You don't see it until you stop looking for it. As it is with ants, so it is with goodness. If you go round looking for it with a mental picture of what goodness ought to mean, your goodometer in your hand, you won't see it. But once you stop looking and are tuned into, well, let's call it the goodness frequency, then you will see it popping up everywhere, just like the ants. I sat outside a pub once, near to a man and his wife. He looked to me just like the owner of a central heating business who perhaps did a little football coaching in his spare time. As you can see, I had a whole biography of him floating in my mind, the way you do when you look at total strangers. Having nothing better to do, I listened to some of their conversation, and I was humbled, humbled absolutely into flatness. Now, whether he was in central heating, I don't know, and whether he coached football, I can't tell you. But what I can tell you is this. He and his wife had spent their whole lives fostering troubled children, and their conversation was all about those children and how they were doing, and their hopes and worries for each of them. They were parents and more than parents, and heroes too. You can see why I felt small. I have no idea if this all added up to a kind of sanctity, still less a canonizable one. For all I know, in his work, this man might be installing cheap plastic pipes when he was charging for expensive copper ones, or might be cheating his workmen out of some of their wages. Equally, he might be doing none of that, we just don't know. Whether he and his wife are saints or not saints isn't the point. The point is that there is goodness everywhere around us, whether we see it or not. You only need to get your eye in for it to be revealed to you. And once you do see it, and in beings not so very different from you, you will want to find a way to live up to it yourself. Now you see why I think that Pope St. John Paul II's canonization of more people like us is such a good thing. If there is sanctity in ordinariness, St. Jean-Baptiste Marie Vianney, who is celebrated on Monday the 4th, is a good candidate. He is more commonly known as the Curé of Arles, because that is what he was, Arles being an isolated village in France, some distance from Lyon. Curé of Arles was all he was, but that all turned out to be a big all, and big enough for heaven. He was born in 1786, which meant that he grew up in the most anti-religious time of the French Revolution. He received his first communion in the kitchen of a neighbour's house, with the blinds drawn down to hide the candles from anyone who might be passing by. As a student for the priesthood, he was more than mediocre. His Latin was particularly bad. He failed his entrance examination for the seminary, but succeeded at the second attempt. Or possibly they just thought they had to let him in, exams or no exams. He seems to have been one of those people who have great knowledge gained by practice, but have no idea how to turn it into theory for answering exam questions. So if you are that sort of person, hopeless at exams because they're just not real, here is a saint who is just like you. Having been ordained despite everything, he was sent to Arles, a tiny and remote village with 250 inhabitants. He never had a career, he just stayed there, with no title except Curé of Arles, until the day he died. All the curé did was be a parish priest. Though calling that all is pretty rich if you think of it, it meant guiding, blessing and protecting his flock, helping them on their way through life and on to heaven. That was his vocation, and he stuck to it. But there was something about this forgotten parish priest in this forgotten location. He couldn't leave his village, but his reputation spread far beyond it. People told people about him. They started coming from miles away to have him hear the confession, from all over France, indeed. The books say that eventually 20,000 people a year would come to him. If you divide that up, that makes an average of 50 people a day coming, kneeling around, and waiting their turn. The curé was spending 16 hours a day in the confessional. You can think the curé dull because he founded no orders, he wasn't even martyred. Reading about his life, there is nothing to read. But this too is sanctity, to do what needs doing without hoping to build a career out of it, just day after day, week after week, year after year, doing what is needed. The curé is a patron saint of parish priests, who can easily find themselves isolated in a parish with nothing to do but their job, isolated and forgotten by everyone, including, often, themselves. But outside the church, out in the world where we live and walk around, there are also many jobs that are forgotten, undervalued, scarcely noticed. The people who do them have nothing to boast about in the pub. Their friends look pityingly on them, worked for the same company all his life. Saint Jean-Baptiste Marie Vianney can be their patron saint too. Or perhaps you are someone who works 16 hours a day because you are doing work which needs doing and there's nobody else who will do it. You may have days when you think what you are doing is good. You may have days when you think what you are doing is pointless. On both kinds of days, pray to the curé of Arles because he is your saint too. This Thursday's other saint, besides Pope Sixtus II and his companions, is probably one of the least talked about saints in English, and this for the most natural, the most embarrassing, the most unacknowledgeable of reasons. No one knows how to pronounce him. In a civilized language, Cayetano, Caetano, Gaetano all sound natural. In English, we can't decide whether to do Cajetan or Cayetan, and they both sound wrong. Rather, as nobody knows whether to call the island of Majorca, Majorca, or whether to call the island of Majorca, Majorca. It doesn't stop people going on holiday there, but somehow it does stop us considering this saint or naming ourselves after him, which is a pity. Gaetano, that's the way I'll try saying him, was one of the fruits of the energy of the Holy Spirit surging through mankind in the Catholic Reformation. His official claim to fame is that he founded the Theatines, a religious order which was meant to work like a monastery on the inside, living in the community together, but outside, like a lot of priests going out into the world to exercise their ministry. It gave them all the possibility of doing their work where it was needed, but having a family to belong to at the same time. What grabs me about Gaetano is not this, but the fact that he also founded a bank. There is a patron saint for everyone, it seems, for armed robbers, for prostitutes, for forgotten people who faithfully do their job in forgotten places. It's one of the glories of the church. But bankers are an embarrassment. I've heard it said that St. Matthew is a patron saint of bankers, but that is illogical, first because he wasn't a banker but a tax collector, and then because the only virtuous thing he seems to have done with his tax collecting business is to abandon it when Jesus called him to be a disciple. Banking is a necessary profession, but morally it is an incredibly dangerous one. It is especially so when it comes to lending money to the poor. A moneylender is someone who might lend £200 to someone, making him agree to pay £300 back. Even a respectable bank will make a loan and then sell the debt to some other business, which is to say, it bundles up a bunch of people, their hopes and dreams, their fears and troubles, and turns them into a commodity to be bought and sold. At least slave dealers have the decency to look at the bodies of the human beings they trade in. In Naples, in about 1539, St. Gaetano inspired some laymen to get together and found a Monte di Pietà, literally a hill of pity, I suppose. We would call it a pawnbroker. We don't think of a pawnbroker as being morally a good thing, but they were a great act of mercy. By letting him pledge the overcoat he wouldn't need till winter, the pawnbroker let the poor man feed his family through the summer until he earned enough at harvest to get his coat back before the weather got cold. Gaetano's wasn't the first Monte di Pietà. The Franciscans and Dominicans had been running them for a couple of centuries. But still, this institution and this saint are good stimulus for us to gather our thoughts. Money and what it is and what it is for and what to do with it, these themes pervade our lives. They control us. Nowadays, we think about them politically, which is to say, we don't really think at all. But if we look back 500 years to Gaetano and the others of his time, we see people seriously thinking, where monetary institutions were concerned, not about doing well, but about doing right. And this not because it looks good in glossy annual reports, but because doing right is the right thing to do. It is the only thing to do. So if you are involved in any aspect of the financial world, don't worry about the pronunciation. Look towards St. Gaetano for your inspiration. Pray to him that you may think clearly about what you are doing. Make him remind you always that with all your cleverness and all your talent and your luck in getting good jobs, you are in this world to serve Christ's poor. Find ways of using your skills to do it, and having found those ways, do them. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.